always seems a nice sort of joy about a memorial service early in the morning. I must say, going back a long time, before I even lived here, there was something really nice about gathering and coming together for a service to remember one of our founders. And of course, every time we do, we give a chance for their lives to sort of impact on ours and encourage us to take that, put our toes in just a little bit deeper at least. And of course, remembering they're doing that in Japan, remembering him too. So for those who perhaps don't know the history so well, he was her Sojin Kanon-roshi was her second teacher, Inoue-kyoni's second teacher, after Sesso Odo-roshi. And if you notice in the chanting, we actually, in the lineage, it's Sesso Odo-roshi that comes in the lineage, because you only have one teacher referred to in the lineage. And her second teacher, we pass over the merit, he's one of the three founders with Sesso himself, and then Miyakoni, when we pass over the merit of the transmission to the founders. That's when we refer to him each morning. We are bringing him to mind when we do the chanting. And he of course followed Sesso Roshi, and if you go to Taitokuji, they have as part of their graveyard area, they have a little separate section, and they have a memorial stones to these small ones like this, big ones, to both Sesso Roshi and Sojin Roshi, kind of in the same precinct. So they were sort of obviously recognised as two masters that somehow came together and must have influenced the temple in a certain way. They bothered to put them completely in their own area as sort of recent Zen masters. And then behind Sesso Roshi is the little one, which apparently is to the dog. Sesso Roshi had a dog. And he gets his at the back there too. So it's a place you can go and just remember those two masters. If you get a chance, it's very moving. Very moving to go there, and there you are in the presence of our ancestors. Quite a powerful thing. So we're remembering him warmly and with great gratitude this morning, and just a little bit of the familiar but hopefully well worth repeating kind of history about how it all came about. So Sesso Roshi died halfway through Venerable Miyakoni's training, after 6 years in 1966, and she came back to England. There's always apparently a bit of a interim before when one master dies, before they select and take the next one takes over. And Sesso Roshi, as we know, has been renowned for being quite a mellow master. You know, obviously he knew how to hold the whip too, but his temperament, and we can see it from the pictures that we have of him. He had a broad smile and an outward warmth to him. And Sojin Roshi was renowned for being more of a fiercer temperament. When he took over, he was sort of pulling things together in a certain way, I guess, and he said he wasn't keen on taking Venerable Miyakoni back. He wasn't keen on taking Westerners or women. I'm not sure all the reasons were. Maybe he wanted to just start off with just the monks and so forth. And apparently it was Sokin Roshi who went to him and said, actually, you know, she's really worth taking or whatever. You know, she's really for the Dharma, and please consider it more seriously or whatever. And Venerable Miyakoni apparently wasn't sure she wanted to train with him because she'd heard of his reputation. She wasn't quite sure that how she'd get on with him. So Sokin Roshi apparently went between the two of them, and he told Venerable Miyakoni it would be a very good way to complete her training to do it with somebody who had this like, different side to his temperament. And he had to go to Sojin Roshi and say, you know, please take her. And fortunately, both sides took his word for it or whatever, and so it came about that she went back to Japan and never regretted, completed her training, going on with him. And we know he entered entered the temple very young. Sometimes happens. I think it was 9 or so he entered, started out with some involvement in the temple. But the first sort of story we have of his is one that he repeated to his monks apparently during a very hard session, and it's about what happened to him when he started going into more serious sessions, presumably in his early 20s. And there was one particularly hard one where it got really tough. And he went to the bell tower. And bell towers in Japanese temples are not, I always imagined it being very high, but actually not very, very high. But they do have, they sort of give you a slight distance from the temple, and you can look around on the precinct. They're normally very nice, quiet places. It's a bit like sort of going onto our balcony, perhaps, and looking around the garden. It's sort of a bit of seclusion to it, and you can look over the scene. And he went up there, wept his eyes out and said, that's it, you know, I may have been doing this a long time already, but actually, I've got alternatives, you know. that's it, I'm leaving. And then the bell went to remind the monks that it's time to go back to the next sitting, and he found his legs just going back to the zendo, and he found himself back on the cushion. And how come, what took him back to the cushion? What decided he was going to leave? And he had the warmth to tell that story during a session, presumably just to remind his monks, now and again we get that feeling that it's completely pear-shaped or completely not for me or something. But if we've been doing it quite a while, it's already set in the body, there's something else which knows. And we said we don't have to take those things, we can see them, and obviously they're there, but something else starts to carry it. Whether I want to do my meditation this evening or whether I don't, somehow we find ourselves, particularly in Shobhan, we find ourselves, don't we? But anywhere after that, it's built, it's the rhythm's there, we find that we've got the strength to just keep going. And Renan McKinney, when she first early on, when she was started to train as a Tokuji with him as the master, I think she was still quite concerned about his outward or his reputation anyway. And she was entering, the story went that she was entering the shrine room after him, but he couldn't see her, so she was sort of behind him somewhere and he was entering. And she said he took his shoes off or whatever the normal way, and it was a cold, frosty morning, and he just stepped back and looked around the garden, and just sort of softened. It was a beautiful scene. It was sort of frosty or something, but quite a really nice morning. And she just saw his sort of softness as he kind of looked around. At that moment, she said, "It's going to be okay," because that warmth actually was there. It's just his way he presented things, or his outward performance, and his the way he sometimes liked to handle his monks was on the tough side. But actually, of course, the warmth had to be there, otherwise it wouldn't have been a genuine training. And she used to say that a lot, didn't she? She used to say, never forget that it's without that warmth, it's nothing. There's maybe no life, could be no feeling. So it's always got to have both that size, that wisdom, which can have that toughness in it. It needs to have that bit of toughness for that real pulling together within it. And then that warmth, which means we can really empathise with others and open up, but never a kind of sentimental one, she'd say. It's always completely from the heart and natural. And sometimes that warmth attitude means being quite rigorous, isn't it? Or very rigorous alongside it. So we don't know much detail about her, the actual training she did with him. She kept that quite private. She did do her training, completed it with him. But we know he had that strictness, that real pulling together. We know he had a lot of monks who actually stayed with him a long time. So despite you might think, well, they'd all run a mile when they met that fiercer master, but actually it doesn't work like that. And apparently he had monks who stayed with him a long time, because there's obviously something about that strictness which people recognised and actually were drawn towards. And so just reflecting on that, in a way we think, well, part of us doesn't like that, often rubs against it, doesn't it? That sort of sense that we're somehow being scolded, or we're being asked to do things we don't want to do, or whatever it is. And then the other side that sort of knows that that's actually a really important part of it, that actually, even though I don't fully understand it right now, there's something, I don't know about everybody else, but my feeling about it is sometimes you could feel both the grumpiness because somehow you're being harangued, but also a sort of knowledge that actually that is, this is working, that something is being rubbed off, something is gradually coming together. And maybe to see both those aspects. And I was thinking about here, what do we find, strict in our training? And maybe for each of us it was something a bit different that actually does rub. And one of the things definitely living here, I think, is for many people, certainly for me, is that we come in from outside, used to communicating in a certain way. And we get here and the way we're asked to communicate is different. And that can feel very, very uncomfortable. Because of course we have our own way of being, and then someone says no, don't behave, talk like that, or don't be so friendly or whatever. I mean, personally, I got scolded. But we all were at the time. We were all being corrected quite a lot on how we opened the door, not chatting too much at the door. Being that extra formality, not having those long sort of conversations. How are you? How are your grandchildren? Or whatever. Just that you're opening someone to a temple, you just let them in. And particularly on the phone too, we were being well groomed for that, really just showing it's a temple and not to do with me answering the phone. And there was one, a small anecdote, once occasion where Brian Appleyard rang to say he wasn't coming to the sitting. And I was in my best form. Yeah, you're not coming to the sitting? Great, I'll tell Ben O'Mahony. And off I went to tell Ben O'Mahony. And she said, well, how was he? And she said, well, you know, he was ill last week. I said, yes. She said, didn't you ask how he was? I said, well, no. That just shows how we can, how we really miss, you know, that's I, isn't it? You know, I'm determined to do it, as I've just been told, which is all very, you know, completely, and completely forget that actually he's been ill and the normal thing. So it's always this, you know, curbing our tendency to just do it my way, but actually learning to do it, of course, from a natural way rather than that contrived way. Because that only comes about through long practice and just repeating and gradually having my way generally shaved off or whatever. But you don't feel like you win, do you? So we all have that. And the thing I was thinking about, the most extreme, probably along the same lines, but the one of the most testing instructions she ever gave me, which I never managed, of course, to do completely, but she once told me not to smile for a year. Well, you can't even do it for 2 minutes once someone tells you, really. But it was one of the toughest instructions, obviously, because it seemed so, you know, don't smile for a year. You know, what, you know, you try to do it for 5 minutes if someone says it to you, you know. But eventually, I didn't obviously manage, you know, anywhere near. It was a very difficult instruction. She went on what to do. It took me ages to work out kind of what I was supposed to do with instruction like that, you know. But obviously I knew, you know, that these instructions have a sense to them. And so our job is to try and find out what it is, isn't it? You know, really to find out, you know, why she'd be telling me that. And gradually it did make some sense as to what she was trying to pull together by saying that. But it's, you know, those constructs are very difficult, aren't they, to actually turn into something that's living and real. And of course, if we take the warmth out of everything, you might think that means going around with a completely gloomy face for the next year, which of course, you know, wasn't trying to create monsters, you know, so that obviously wasn't it. That's why I took it at first, thought she just wanted me to look grumpy, so I'll look grumpy, you know. That obviously wasn't that, you know. But to find out what these instructions mean is what we're here for, isn't it, when we get difficult ones. And in the training, when situations start up, they matter. It doesn't have to be as formal as a Zen master. Life does it all the time, doesn't it? Some difficult situations, and then we have to work our way. But if we treat it in the context of the training, then we've always got the chance to allow us to mature through it, rather than just, you know, become very upset by it, or not only become very upset by it, but allow it to be a really growing long time. So we presume, we don't know the details, but we presume for his students he was testing them in these various kinds of ways pretty rigorously once he got to be the Lord Abbot of Daitokuji. And he certainly really allowed Ben O'Mahony to ripen her own training, working with him. And I do know that he took a lot of time with her, that her interviews went on quite a bit longer apparently than other people's, you know, the queue behind her, because of the language or whatever. He obviously took a lot of trouble to make sure she was understanding. So I have got reports that her interviews went on and the other monks were, you know, there. Because he was obviously having just to take that time to make sure that she really had got the language side of it, which the other monks would have been getting, obviously, immediately. So he obviously did really take her on once he'd said yes to it. We do know a little bit about what he said when she was about to go back to England. We know that some various monks put a lot of pressure on her to stay in Japan, and she had to really stick to her guns and say, no, I did this training in order to take it back to London. And she was under quite a lot of pressure, apparently, from that score. When she went to give her farewell to him, so to speak, they had a friendly discussion, conversation, and she said, could you come to England? And he apparently said, no, I'm a prisoner here. And her face kind of fell. He said, no, 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 prisoner of my own making, of course. You know. But then he said, would I be able to fly? Because apparently he actually liked flying. And she said, yeah, well, yes, now we can fly to England. So he was, unfortunately, he died in office. And so unfortunately, it was he wasn't able to fulfil that. And Sokoroshi, of course, then did really, later on his behalf, so to speak, was the one who came over and supported the group for many years. So he wasn't able to. But in that conversation, he also asked her what she was going to do when she came back to England. And she said, as she put it, I made the mistake of telling him. And she, you know, said she'd go on at the Buddhist Society where they had a little group and so forth. You know, they'd started something and she'd be going there. And he said, you'll do nothing of the sort. And he said, when you get to London, you'll sit at the airport, arrive at the airport, and you'll just sit there. And if anybody notices you, and you know, they might give you food and lodgings or whatever, and then you may have the opportunity to teach. And if they don't, you'll die at the airport. And she said, Christmas Humphreys came to meet her, so she didn't get the opportunity to sit and do begging at the at London at Heathrow. But she said she never forgot the spirit of that instruction. So she, you know, obviously she knew that how to take that instruction, and that it was never about trying to please other people around and to do it the way that would please other people, but actually just showing them her strength and what she could, how it was, in the spirit of the tradition, which says Cecil. She said to her, I can only teach the way I was taught. You know, I can only teach that. I can't teach anything else, you know, because that's the school I'm in, and either people think go with that or it's not for them. They don't. We can't kind of start doing different things for different people or whatever. We just do what we do. We show them that strength, and then hopefully for some people it's just the right thing, and they'll be able to walk the way. So she's never forgot that instruction, and hopefully we don't forget that instruction, that actually it's been done in a certain way, and it's up to us to the best of our ability to follow it in that spirit, of course, within our own being, so we don't end up like Sojourn Roshi. We don't end up not trying to be like Venerable Mukheni. We're learning through that practice to find out what we're actually, the truer self of ourselves, of course, and not it can never be an imitation, because that would be a dead, dry kind of a thing. It has to be something truly living for each and every one of us. Thank you, so we'll leave it here for this one.